This is an interview with Mr. L.V. T. Witt for the Youngstown State University Law School Graduates Project by Paul Carlson at 264 North Heights, Youngstown, Ohio, on the 5th of May, 1977, at 3 o'clock p.m. Mr. Witt, could you tell us something about your background?
I'm married to Lynn Keffer. I'm 75 years old. We have had 5 children. One of whom died in infancy. One of whom became a professor at Youngstown College in music. And died 1967. His wife died in 1968. Leaving 5 children, whom we have reared, and have now living with us 1 grandchild, Robert Charles Witt. I started practicing law in 1927, continued in the practice of law by myself until the present time, and have served over 50 years in the practice of law. Besides the 1 boy who is since deceased, we have 3 daughters. Do you want their names?
Okay.
Who are named Mrs. Irvin Sanders. Mrs. Irvin Sanders. Mrs. John Carlin and Mrs. Gloria or Nick Reachmack, Reachmack. We are going to celebrate our 50th wedding anniversary next month.
Could you tell us something about your family, your parents?
Yeah. I am a descendant of a German family who emigrated to this country in about 1872. I am the grandson of Nicholas and Catherine Governor. In German, known as Gouverneur, if you want to that. They came from Trier, Rheinpreisen, Germany, in the Alsace-Lorraine district, which is now known as Munich or München. My grandfather was a coal miner by profession and then later started in farming. He lived in Vienna, Ohio. And Girard, Ohio, in his later years. My father was Joseph Witt, and mother, Mary Elizabeth Governor Witt. My father was, during the biggest part of his life, was an undertaker. And later, in the latter years of his life, became a grocer. And, my father died in 1943, and mother died in 1951. Is that enough of that?
What do you remember about your early experiences growing up in Youngstown?
Oh, I grew up the same as any other kid did in the city. We lived on Grant Street. Until about 1919, and then moved to Arlington Street and lived there for 28 years. And I grew up in a neighborhood where the corner gang was the peer group and had such neighbors as Quinlan of the police department, Dunkel, a carpenter, contractor, Joyce, a contractor, cement contractor, and we just grew up. And if that's, I don't know what else to say. It is one of my early neighbors was Sigelhop on Grant Street and on Arlington, when we moved to Arlington Street, who is now a judge. Of course, that's not important either.
That's St. Columbus, why don't we
want
that?
Oh, yes, I went to St. Columbus School and parochial school, graduated from there, went to law school, graduated from there, started practicing law, and never quit.
Think the early influences were on you that maybe steered you towards law, or when did you decide you wanted to go to law school, or why did you?
Well, I always wanted to be a lawyer. It's the only thing I ever did want to be. And I was encouraged in that by my mother and father and brothers and sisters. And passed the bar examination in due time and started practicing law. And about 1927 or 26, I started practicing law and run right into head on into the Depression of 1930. I never quit practicing law, even in spite of the hard times, and continued in the practice until the present time. Of course, at the present time, I am retired. I don't do anything except consult with a couple of friends or so who want to talk to me. I talk to them.
As far as your early schooling, then, I noticed in one of the articles I read in the Vindicator that you had a flair for history. Was that one of your favorite subjects, or did you just?
Well, I had a flair for reading. And I always did like history and have done quite some work on Civil War subjects and have made biography and history the main sources of my reading material other than law. I guess that's right. cut the machine. I had a series of articles on historical subjects, mostly being generals of the Civil War period, concerning generals particularly of the southern states, see, of the Confederacy. And I have one of them here that's dated, was given over WKBN radio on April 25th, 1938 at 7:45 p.m. That would be the general date of when these were issued. Was there within a year or 2 years of that date, see. Now, was headed a series under Southern Skies. Here, throw this away, Mums. Mm-hmm. tear it up. Oh, these darn things. I see the power squad and certificate of appreciation. I have done many articles for radio stations. They're so numerous that I can't recall them, of many subjects, usually along historical lines. Now, I've got some of them here. I haven't made a fetish of keeping these, but these are some that I've got, and there's many more that I haven't got. I would give them over the radio station for a period of about 3 or 4 years, and they were all a general subject and the general idea of history of what I mentioned. And as you can see here, I see now that I got a clipping here from November 29, 1935, in which I invited William E. Borah, who was a leading contender for the presidency at that time. And I wrote a letter to him and invited him to come, and he said he would, but he didn't.
Okay. Invite him to speak on the show or interview him?
No, to come here to address us. And he promised to, and he says he's not made any speaking engagements, but I greatly appreciate your letter and shall keep it for future reference, but he did do it. And certificates of appreciation from the Liberty Optimist Club, Power Squadron, certificates of membership in Power Squadron, which was an educational project we had here in town for the Power Squadron, which is still in existence, boating.
I noticed that you attended Hall's Business College.
Yes, I attended Hall's Business College, and which was the foremost business college in the city at the time, and graduated from there, both in bookkeeping and stenographic work.
Could you tell us what you remember about your law school days?
Not much. Well, I get organized on that.
It's okay.
Shut your machine off, will you? I was one of his campaign men and quite an interested man in him. I was Assistant Attorney General to Tom Herbert when he was Attorney General of the state. And I was assistant to Hugh Jenkins when he was Attorney General of the state. And I worked in all phases of the legal affairs of the state. Now, I can't tell you what I did. We did whatever we were assigned to do, whatever work come up to do, and anything of the kind. And I was sent, I traveled all over the United States trying cases for the
for the state of Ohio. I traveled on one trip. Mrs. Witt and I traveled We tried cases and, well, no, wait. On one trip, I went to try to take care of legal work for the Attorney General in Mayo Clinic up at, where was it?
Seattle. And then down into California, was it Mercedes?
In California? Well, we made a circle trip from Youngstown to California. Spokane and Bakersfield and Los Angeles and many points in between, because when we set a trip up to go that way, we would touch all bases. Every place where we had any work to be done, I took care of. And that was on one trip. On other trips, I went New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, and other points in between. My regular assignment took me to these places. Now that's just, I made many trips, see, to Philadelphia, Baltimore, New York, Boston, and places of that kind. And just, that was routine work for us.
You were instrumental in, Attorney General Brooker's, he ran for governor in 36, right? And you probably played a part in that campaign?
He ran for governor in, if 36 is a year, yes. I got these dates all wrong. Yeah. I don't know what. I don't want to give you any dates to be accurate and show them.
Okay.
But I...
Didn't he run for Attorney General at that time?
He ran for Attorney General, no. He ran for governor in 36.
Oh.
He was attorney general. And then he was defeated for governor once, I think. I don't know whether he was defeated for governor once.
That's not really important.
No, that isn't important. I was involved with Governor Bricker when he was governor for all of his terms. Then I was involved with Tom Herbert. Tom Herbert went from Attorney General to Governor. I was involved with him, say, in both Attorney General and Governor. And then Hugh Jenkins came after them, followed them as Attorney General. I was involved with him as Attorney General. And I've been with these fellows. As a matter of course, we just traveled with them all the time. If we was in town, well, we'd be with them. And if they wanted us, they called us. And if they didn't, why, we went about our business, you know. But we were the ones that we'd be in their office, and He'd call us up and talk to us and everything of that kind of thing.
Did you get along better with any one of them more so than?
I got along with everybody. I wouldn't say there's anybody that I had any difference with, nor had any feuds with, or anything kind. I did my work, did what was assigned to me, went where I was supposed to be, and took care of my business as best I could. When they assigned us to go any place, they'd send us here. They'd give us an order, go to Chicago, or go to Philadelphia, go to New York, go to wherever it is, and they'd have their cases set up for us. See? And we'd go in and handle whatever matter was there for us, and then come home when we could. And when I went on this trip around to California, I went and I had my assignments, and I went in, took care of them, whatever was to be done, nobody to tell me what to do, just to take care of them.
Sounds like that had to have been very challenging. Challenging, exciting, or was it very strenuous?
It was exciting, but the glory is gone. It's a has been thing now. I'm just another has been. See, I've had many cases that were notable, many cases that were immense, handled cases amounting to millions of dollars. And everything of that kind, but we don't talk about those things. I don't. There's cases where you send in on them, and they're just routine. See, they're just routine cases, and you don't even think of them after they're over. You go in, take care of your work, go on to the next job. And I don't know what to tell you about them.
Well, you've told me quite a bit. What about the year again is unimportant, but I noticed that in 37, you were a candidate for municipal judge. Do you recall that? Anything about that episode in your life?
No, wait a minute. Cut it out. I don't want to. That was the one mistake I made in my life, or rather, that was the only mistake I made that I run for office. See, if I hadn't run for office, everything would have been happy and everything else. But I run for office and I was defeated. And I'm not proud of it, and I'm not ashamed of it in any respect. But I was interested in politics all my life. And many dinners for people here and different candidates, different ones that were running for office, and such as that. And Mayor, in Marilyn E. Evans' campaign. I run
1935 or 36.
Yeah, Bob was in that. In 36, I think. When Lionel Evans was running for mayor, my son made several talks for him. He was about 4 years old then, or five. And he made talks for him.
Yeah?
Yes. So that's the son that died.
This boy his father.
This boy's father. And, I don't know. Got any other subjects?
Well, you spent those 7 years in the state office. What was it like to come back here and set up practice? Did you have to start a whole new routine again then when you set up your own office?
Yes. But I was better acquainted, and it was then that I started in on a specialized practice, workman's compensation. I was the only workman's compensation I ain't going to say specialist, but yet I gravitated towards that practice, and it was I became known as being knowledgeable of workman's compensation and pursued that practice then for the rest of my years of practice. So that's, and in that I, while I was representing the state, I had several cases that were rather memorable, where about 145 men were killed in one accident, and I represented the state in connection with that. I was East Ohio Gas Company of Cleveland, and there was another one where there was about 140 men killed in an accident in a coal mine in Martin's Ferry, or no, don't say Martin's Ferry, it was in the southern part of the state, and I represented them in that case. And there were many, many other cases that had individual problems with, that were new problems that we had to deal with. Because the law was changed, and with every change of the law, it became different problems involved with it. And so from the time of 36, when I first started in workman's compensation, until the rest of my life I was involved in workman's compensation, either for the state or for the claimant.
What do you remember about your race with for mayor and against Frank Friesen? That seemed to be quite a challenging period for
let's see, that's what he defeated me, didn't he?
No, you were only in primary on that.
Oh, yeah. I'd rather not talk about the what I've been in race. I've been in them, and I just don't want to talk about them because they're not a satisfying portion of my activity.
Okay.
I'd rather think of the time that I was helping somebody else. Because most of my life, most of my actual working was in the helping of people who were in need, who were injured, who were out of work, and such as that. And I was engaged most of the time in trying to help them get some money. And that's what I want to think of as being the times that I spent in helping people. I'd take a case, and when it was hopeless, and try to come up with something of a novel experience or something where I could get in and make a case for them. And that's where I made a reputation for being skillful in seeing what is necessary to make a case. And I distinctly remember one case. I'm not going to start naming cases, but where I got money for three different widows. From the workman's compensation. I can't go on.
Okay.
Teddy Johnson, Theodore Johnson, was dean when I first started there. And then Judge Gessner was dean of it, of the school. And then I think, I don't know who else became after, Scarborough, I think, became dean of it for a little while. And
They should have that record down.
Yes, they got that record down. They don't want that. And Theodore Johnson was a very fine dean. And Judge Gessner was a very fine dean. But those two men were at odds on the way to handle the school, until it was that Dean Johnson resigned and Judge Gessner was put in charge. Well, there's nothing to tell about a law school. It's just a law school, that's all. You go in and you fight arguments, you argue about cases, and you may, one case may mean something, may not mean anything. So.
Were they good instructors? Did you learn a lot from instructors?
Learned enough to pass the bar examination.
In fact, you got one of the highest grades on record. I saw that. At least they said that in the Vindicator, that your score on the bar was one of the highest they had on record.
I'd rather not talk about that. I got I got past the bar examination on the first trial. See? And that's all needs to be said. I passed the bar examination the first time I took it. And I had a good grade. I don't know. If you want to know what grade I got it in the file there. I don't care what it is. I passed it. And there were a lot of them that didn't pass the first time. What's that?
I think that would be a record vindicator too.
Yeah.
What grade you made.
I don't know what grade it was.
I don't
know. Let me tell you one. Now don't make a record of this because there was a fellow by the name of Kedge Powell. This was a, you shut that off, did you?
No, I didn't.
I won't.
You don't want this on
tape?
No,
don't put this on tape.
Of the restrictions.
to the company, the ship company, not to him. And they put it to his credit. And then he, they sent him over. Came over here in 1949, sometime. And immediately he came over here, he applied for citizenship as soon as possible. Thanksgiving time is when he came over. And he immediately applied and took steps to join the United States Air Force. Of course, there were complications in that, too, because of his foreground. But he did join the Air Force. He said that he wanted to join the Air Force too, so that he could say that he joined up with our Army as quick as he possibly could. He joined the Air Force here in this country. He worked for a cheap tube company about 6 months or a year before he was able to sign up for the Air Force. He got in the Air Force and was trained up in Ticonderoga, I think it was, New York State anyway. And he went through all the training and came back and was stayed with us a while longer until he was assigned. He was assigned to Japan. That is after his boot training. Went to Japan, and the boy was a very intelligent young man, and he studied linguistics and studied Japanese when he was over there, and became very fluent in Japanese language. He was over in Japan for 2 years to the day until he shipped back to this country. He came back and finished out his term of 4 years of service in the Army and lived with us during the period of 4 years when he was not at the Army installations. He came here and lived with us. Later, sent to somewhere in Tennessee, and down there he met a young lady whose uncle was the Archbishop of Louisville, Kentucky, and he married. Now is in Cupertino, California, as an official of the United Airlines. He went to school all the time that he could, when he was here, when he was in the Army, and when he was stationed in New York for a period of time, and in Washington, D.C. He studied languages. He was very fluent in German, Russian, French. Scotia has done in, over the country, all over the world, I might say, in all of the country for the United Airlines, and he is the one who, when they have an accident, any place in the country, he goes to it, looks at the property that they have, their plane, how bad it's damaged, and provides for whether it be taken to their home office to be repaired, or whether it can be repaired on the in field. And he's, at this time, he has two children. One of them is in college and one in high school. And he's living with his wife and the two children in Cupertino. And we hope he'll be home to our home, as he calls us mother and dad, and refers to this place as being his home for our celebration next month, next 2 weeks. Expect to have a very fine reunion with him after their family in a couple of weeks. So that's about as much as I can tell you for that, except that he's always been very kind to us, and I don't regret one little of the money that we spent on him. By the way, it was all paid back to me, and I don't regret that I've taken care of them and made them part of our family. We call him, although he is not adopted in any respect, we call him our adopted son and his family. Away from him. He came to Youngstown and later on met a girl, married her here, had a family, I think three children. And then after he was here 4, 5, or 6 years, they finally arrested jailbreak. And since I had worked on the railroad, I knew him. And he knew me, of course. And they wanted to start a petition because of his good behavior in Youngstown. Nobody had any complaints about him at all. They wanted to refuse to allow the governor of Virginia to extradite him. And when I got into the matter, which was voluntary on my part and free, no charge made to him for anything, but the telegram was one of the city's newspapers. They got into it and they made a cause celebre out of it. And there was another lawyer in Youngstown whom he had known, and he wanted discussion as to whether or not we should have them refuse to turn them over to the Virginia, or whether or not we should try to have him go to Virginia, get him fired, and then he would be free. And it became very acrimonious as to what it was. It's my contention that we should take him back to Virginia, because the governor of Virginia refused to consider his pardon or consider any consideration for him until he became again a prisoner in their state. And I prevailed on it, and I was told by everybody involved that think that that's the thing to do, you take him back. And the Telegram Publishing Company, which is now part of the Vindicator Publishing Company, provide us with an automobile and my wife, my father, and I took him back to prison and delivered him to the penitentiary. Much of a job to have him put in the penitentiary as it was to get him out. It was in fact more of a job, because as they told me at that time, that they had many, many, many men who would bring a man in and try to get him in the penitentiary to provide knowledge and information to other prisoners for jailbreak. Got him in the penitentiary about noon one day. And by the way, we had my father and my wife and I had dinner with the prison officials, and it was a very good dinner too. And we took him, turned him in that afternoon, and then went to the governor without having any previous knowledge of the governor's actions, or without ever having any contact with him. We went in to see the governor, and he gave us an audience that afternoon. And a very fine governor, I don't recall his name at this time, but within 3 days, we had him out, and he came home with us again. And from that day on, he's been a fine citizen. It was the quickest pardon that was ever given by this governor to anyone that had escaped. And at the same time, while in Richmond, Virginia, all the fortifications of Virginia during the Civil War, made a tour of that area, and was very much impressed with the city of Richmond by the treatment that they gave at that time. At that time, I was very much interested in history, and I had the good fortune, pleasurable experience of visiting in the courthouse where Aaron Burr was tried for his derelictions in the processes with Alexander Hamilton. I have been one of Aaron Burr's great friends even before that, but at that time I made a better study of it, a more
governor, all he would tell us when we talked to him on the afternoon was, I will consider it. I will consider it. I will think of it. And he said, well, how long will it take? He said, well, call me tomorrow. We called him the next day, and he said, well, if you can stay 3 days, I think you can work it out. And that was the first news that I had that he was even going to consider it. But he did consider it and granted him a part, even paid him, I think, $3 and something for having spent 30 days in jail. Places in the United States, and I want to take that. Now that's what I want to do. Is this machine running now? Well, we left here, left Youngstown on about the 1st of July, 1945. This is at the period of time that United Nations was just formed at San Francisco, so that we went to Bremerton. First, we went to Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. It was our first stop. We went to Bremerton. North of Seattle. We went to many cities, such as San Francisco, Los Angeles, City Roundup Group, Colorado, I think, and various cities throughout the country. And we took testimony of each individual case. I was accompanied by the attorney for plaintiff, who was plaintiff in all these cases. And Mrs. Witt and I traveled by car and met him at various places that we stopped at to take the test. And went throughout the United States and crisscrossed it quite a bit, and for 30 days before we came home. And at that time I was privileged to witness a naval show, which was in Bremerton, which was about 40 ships of the Russian Navy who had come over to this part of the country to fight the Japanese, but who were on their way back to Russia by way of the Panama Canal. And it was a wonderful sight to see. I naturally, as we went around these places, as we got into each city, we would go to the points of interest, such as Yosemite National Park, the Seal Rocks of California, and various, any other point of interest that there was. If we were near, we always had time enough to go and see them, because we were traveling. We'd only spend maybe an hour and a half to 3 hours taking testimony in a day. So it was at Crater Lake Park. And, well, just any of the sightseeing points of interest in the United States. Yes, we combined the pleasure with the work because we were traveling. Had a car, was traveling by car, and when we got someplace that was of interest to us, we would go and see it, such as the in California, Los Angeles. We had San Francisco. We had dinner at the Fisherman's Wharf, and we stopped at the Hilton. Top of the Mark Hotel in San Francisco, Mark Hopkins Hotel. It was a hotel that had one of the first that had a revolving turret at the top, and you'd sit in it and you'd see the entire panorama of the entire city as it went around. And we got to there just about the time that the United Nations was signed, the agreement concerning the United Nations was signed, and it broke up while we were in San Francisco. And we saw, of course, many of the dignitaries of the governments involved in the United Nations.
I told you about all there is about
law school when I started, and Gessner, Judge Gessner, was a teacher there. And they, I do not know whatever started their feud, but it was a feud. Each of these men, I don't mean to say hated each other, but they were disagreeable with each other. They had some point that they didn't agree on the operation of the school. And they finally got to the point where Judge Gessner said he was going to quit. Teddy Johnson said he was going to quit. He didn't want both of them to quit. So we, at the time, paraded. But there was only about 45 of us in the school at the time. And after school one night, we paraded from there, from the school, to North Height. Fair Green Avenue, where the president of the YMCA, which was operating the school at that time, lived. We went and told him what we were there for, and we wanted them to settle this matter because it was detrimental to the school. President of the YMCA's name at that time was Leroy Manchester. And he was very graciously received us and told us to quiet down, as we were very rambunctious and noisy and on such a mission. And he told us that he'd take care of it as best he could. Quieted down and went back to not school that night because it was after school that we came up. All we know is that later on, Theodore Johnson resigned and Judge Gessner was appointed dean of the law school. And he was a different type of man than Johnson. Johnson was very sarcastic and he took a front at most anything was in. He would take anything that you said and try to make it into an argument or to perhaps teach you how to get around things in law. Well, Judge Gessner was a man of much greater consideration, and the judge was always pleasant, courteous, and thoughtful and helpful. Judge Gessner lived to be elected, to be elected as municipal judge and common pleas judge. So we don't know what happened, except that they did settle the matter, of course, which was satisfactory to us. Is that all? Is this still running? Of course. Martins Ferry area, and many times like that. I also handled cases which concerned the Cleveland Clinic fire, wherein there was some 40 or 50 people who were died as a result of X-ray films burning in the Cleveland Clinic fire. About personal experiences? Personal. Well, another thing that I did, I was commander of the United States Power Squad, USPS, in 1961-1962. I had been a member for some 4 or 5 years before that, and afterward also. And the United States Power Squad is a boating fraternity or group that joined to teach us safe boating, and as being commander, chief commander of it, I naturally represented it and all. Another incident that I think is noteworthy to me is that, do you know what Esperanto is? Well, Esperanto is a language that's an artificial language. It's written, composed and written by one man for a universal language. And back in 1935 or so, 36, something like that, I started learning that. I became very proficient in it. Had a club here in Youngstown that fostered it. And we got together and talked it. And although I would hate to try to give you much of it now, I was rather proficient. And that was at a time when my son was about 5, 6, or 7 years old. And Mrs. Whipped also became very proficient in language, and we used to try to talk to each other when my son, who was, as I say, 5, 6, or 7 years old, we didn't want him to understand what we were talking about, and it was only a very short time until he was talking with us. Well, as we were, and we really didn't know that he was paying much attention to us. And it is still in use. It's in use for foreigners from different countries, people from different countries, getting together to talk under the best language. It's a very simple language, and it's very expressive, and it's something that can be learned in a year or so. And, we had much fun with it, and by corresponding with people throughout the world, because they have clubs throughout the world. And if you want to correspond with anybody in any country. All you have to do is write to someone that you know in that country or someone and get their name and address, and they're always willing to write to you. That's the universal language. About 1942, three or four, we started NACA here in town, and it was previously been started in Boston about 1 year before that. Ours was about the second or third society or organization of NACA in the country. It was composed of lawyers who were specialists in compensation matters, workers' compensation matters. And about that time, they had been talking about forming a cohesive organization, getting members in throughout the country. So at that time, I was one of the workers' compensation lawyers in Youngstown who was specializing in workers' compensation. Now, this must have been about 47 or 48, because I think it was after 45. And we got together, a group, we had a convention. First convention was in Cleveland. And that convention, I was appointed one of five members of NACA formulate a constitution of the bylaws of NACA. It now has grown quite extensively, and there are many lawyers now working on compensation cases. In fact, the Workers' Compensation of the State of Ohio is having an investigation for so-called activities which they do not approve of, or but they, I don't know what the result of that has been, because I have been out of it for about 15 years. I can't tell you what the latest is on. NACA published books concerning the cases of workers' compensation and how to handle them. In that connection, I might say that I attended one convention of it in Boston. And it was in Boston the day that the Old North Church, Paul Revere fame, blown off the tower of the church. We were one of the last to see see it off the tower, on the ground. That was, at that time, you can check the date of that, and you notice when it is. Now, we had an organization before that, because that was about the fifth or sixth or seventh convention. You can check whatever date that was. Constitution bylaw. It has been revised several times since because we were very new at the work and had many problems that come up since that time that we had to take care of before that time. I got a lot of stories to tell you about that. But, well, it just happened that I think it was in 1915. I was playing with the dog, which was owned by a grocer near our dog became excited because I had a stick and we'd have the dog grab the stick and I would swing him around and hit him on with his feet. And he must have got excited a little bit because he thought he wanted more of my face and the stick. And he started jumping on me. And it was a dog, American Bulldog. Roller skates. And he jumped on me and he grabbed me by the nose. And I put my hands in his jaws and pulled it apart, but he still tore my nose off and got me about five or six places on the body. I still have my nose, though, due to the fact that the doctor came and attended me. He came to the hospital within about 10 or 15 minutes after I was in there and sewed it back to place. And as you can see now, it's very irregular. That's one of the things that I thought I was going to lose. No. Dog was subsequently shot. That's not all there is to that.
I think we worked the outline that you gave me last time to cover those major points. I don't have any more specific questions to ask you unless you have something you'd like to discuss further.
Well, is that going?
Yes.
Yeah. that's about the end of it. Yeah, my doctor is more than overjoyed that I was defeated, because at that time suggested he would not permit me to run. If he had known that I was going, but it was shortly after that that I took a stroke. Somewhat disabled ever since. However, I will say that I did run twice for judge, municipal judge of the city of Youngstown. Once after when Tom Herbert was in as governor upon the death of Harry Hoffman, who was a judge of the Municipal Court of Youngstown, died in office. Tom Herbert offered me the job to fulfill the expired term, and then chances are I would have run and been elected. But by this time, my career in law had taken such an advance that I was making much more money than what that job would have paid me. So I turned it down, and Frank Ancelotti was given the job. I helped Frank Ancelotti get the job because I've been personally acquainted with Tom Herbert. Wanted the job, by election I couldn't get it. And when I didn't want it, they offered it. Now that was before I ran for mayor. That was, I think it was 45, 46, 47. I don't want to be trying to give exact dates on this. What that particularly noted, that I don't mean to say these are exact dates. So that's about all I was to say about that. I don't know what else. I've told you so many lies now.